I always like coming to Canada because I get some good Canadian cheddar, which is, I really like cheese, so this is very important to me. So yeah, today I'm going to tell you about entanglements and the Fermi surface. And let me just start out by acknowledging my collaborators. Lisa and Subir are both at Harvard right now. Zintel's at Harvard on sabbatical, normally at MIT, and Jeremy and Norm are both at UIUC, Urbana-Champaign. And I'm funded by the Simons Foundation. Okay, so first I'll talk about some motivation and background. So here's the star of our talk, entanglement. So we're always going to think about having a large many-body system, here the composite system AB. And what I'm interested in is the entanglement of A with B. So A and B are in a collective pure state, but A and B can be entangled, right? So it may not be a product state between A and B. And here's the sort of simplest version of entanglement. This is a singlet. And this singlet, you can detect the entanglement in this state by just looking at the entanglement entropy, or in fact, the Runge entropy, which is defined here. And it's sort of log two is like, or one bit is the elementary unit of entanglement. Right? And so we're going to be all interested in computing this quantity, the Runge entropy, or the entanglement entropy, the limit of n goes to one of that expression, which is trace rho log rho. We're going to be interested in computing that in systems with a Fermi surface. We want to understand everything about this problem. Okay, and before I go any further, let me just say this is a cartoon of the basic rule about entanglement in many-body systems, which is that there's an area law. So the entanglement of A with its environment is basically proportional to the perimeter of A, in this case, to the boundary. And that the cartoon of that is that there's just a bunch of singlets, local singlets that are shared across the boundary. Now, of course, I'm going to talk about fermions later on, but this is kind of quasi-general intuition. Now, it turns out the fermions violate this law, so we're going to understand that. Okay, but first, let me step back and just say, why entanglement? Well, basically, the problem we're really interested in, at least I'm really interested in, is this nebulous concept of quantum matter, right? So anything where you put a lot of quantum constituents together and they do something interesting when they're collective dynamics, something in which quantum mechanics plays an essential role. So here's a IPC superconductor. There's all kinds of interesting phases that are realized in this material. This is a fraction quantum Hall, where again, entanglement is very important. It's a topological phase of matter. And this is a black hole, artist's rendition. And because of the miracle of holography, it turns out this is actually related to quantum matter as well. But that's tomorrow, so if you want to hear about that, you should come back. Okay, so some lists of why we care. Well, it's certainly entanglement can be thought of as a resource. So you can do these quantum information protocols, you can move quantum information around, you can do measurement-based quantum computation or topological quantum computation. So this is an interesting perspective. But it's still not really something we can do in a day-to-day setting. But from my perspective, a more interesting thing is the idea of entanglement as a diagnostic of phases. For example, topological entanglement entropy, which I'll tell you about in just a second by way of introduction, and then more interestingly to me, Fermi surfaces, which we'll talk about the rest of the talk. And then again, tomorrow is some of what I've called foundational, sort of understanding the basic structure of entanglement in many-body systems and how that may relate to holographic duality or other interesting foundational questions in quantum matter. Okay, but so today it's really Fermi surfaces. So here's no Fermi surface here yet, but this is an example of where entanglement has played an important role. So this lattice is a Kagome lattice, and this Hamiltonian is the Heisenberg, nearest neighbor Heisenberg model of Kagome lattice. And this lattice has the property that it's frustrated, which means you can't sort of assign the spins in a simple way to minimize the energy. And so it was long believed that if you include quantum fluctuations, that you're going to get some kind of interesting state. Maybe it forms a big crystal, maybe it forms what's called a spin liquid, where the spins remain, if you like, fluid down to arbitrarily low energies. But the problem with that is that's great intuition. It's great intuition to have this picture of spins fluctuating, but it's not a very precise statement about what you want to, how to characterize this state, right? So along comes topological entanglement entropy. And that says you just look at some region here, this circle, the linear size L, and you look at the entanglement entropy of that region, and it's supposed to look like this. It's supposed to have a linear and L part, and then some subleading current term, which is a constant, this function of L. And this subleading term is supposed to be some universal number, in this case, log two for the simplest Z2 spin liquid. And the great triumph of recently using DMRG is on sort of like tubes, long tubes. is that they first of all show that it is a spin liquid, or it looks like a spin liquid in the sense that there's no obvious ordering pattern. And then later, Zhang, Wang, and Balanch actually computed this entropy and found that it's log 2. Okay, so it's sort of a definite signature that there's some topological structure here. We don't still don't know what exactly it is, but we know it's topological. So it's a positive characterization. So this is the kind of job that entanglement is ideally suited for, because there's no local probe that will tell you that this is a topological state. That's the point of it being topological. Okay, but we're not going to talk about this. This is a gap system. It's too trivial for us. We want to do something more complicated. Let me just say, in principle, it is possible to measure these Rényi entropies experimentally, quote unquote, for integer n greater than 1. The fine print is that it requires a very delicate quantum coherent process. So a quantum computer can, in principle, do this, but it requires, you know, to do some coherent manipulation of many copies of the system. And the signal is exponentially small in Sn, so it's not formally efficient as a function of Sn. It's exponentially small in Sn. Nevertheless, you can do it in principle. And an important addendum is that there are classical numerical algorithms like DMRG, or also, which will feature prominently in this talk, quantum Monte Carlo, which people here have been heavily involved in, where you can still compute this Sn numerically classically. So in a sense, we do have numerically experimental data for these entropies that we're going to want to compare with. So that's going to be a big part of the talk later, is comparing. So why Fermi liquids, or systems of the Fermi surface more generally? Well, first of all, they're interesting and ubiquitous. Sort of every, you know, almost all metals that you can think about, you know, like sodium or something like this, these are Fermi liquids. They have a Fermi surface. They're highly entangled, as I'll explain later. They violate this area law for entanglement. And they also tell us what the limits of entanglement-based simulation methods, because these methods typically rely on the area law. Okay, they're also interacting but tractable, as I'll show you. We can basically do everything. And there's contact with more exotic systems. So, for example, these organic salts that may have a spin liquid ground state, or even holographic systems. So the overall message is just that they're interesting and they're tractable, and so it's a wonderful testbed for thinking about all the different properties of entanglement in some extended many-body system, which is gapless. So here's the main question: what's the entanglement structure of a quantum ground state with a Fermi surface? This is the question we're going to address. And here's a preview of what we're going to talk about. So first I'll tell you about the basic scaling structure, the Wittem formula, which is a very important formula, and then this one-dimensional formulation that I pioneered. Then I'm talking about universality, so what happens when you turn on interactions, this idea of thermal entanglement crossovers and entanglement sum rules, and then also oscillating terms, so subleading terms that also know about the Fermi surface. This is recent work with Jeremy and Norm, and this comparison with quantum Monte Carlo data. Okay, so that's the kind of overview. So let's get into it. This is solid state physics 101, right? So here's since I'm in a perimeter, I thought I'd put a Dirac cone instead of a quadratic band here. So you can fill this up to some chemical potential, right? And you have some surface, or in this case, a line of zero energy excitations in the K-space, right? So here's a picture. Everything inside gamma, this gamma is the Fermi C, everything inside this blue circle is filled electron states. And then there are various kinds of excitations. So for example, you can take a particle here and put it outside, that's a particle hole excitation. Or you could take this Fermi surface and just shrink and expand the whole surface. That's like a density fluctuation, some kind of long wavelength collective mode. This would be zero sound or the plasmon in a system with a Coulomb interaction. And I have some electrons or some fermions, which I'm just going to consider to be spinless. Spin is not hard to include, but it's just a Necker complication. And the idea is you linearize the dispersion relation around the chemical potential, right, the energy, and you get this universal form where there's some Fermi velocity VF, and it vanishes at the Fermi energy. So everybody inside is filled, everybody outside is filled. Okay, so that's the ground state. And this is a very nice picture because it tells you how to compute all kinds of interesting things. For example, if you want to compute the thermal entropy, the way to think about it is the following. You just have your Fermi C, and then you have this kind of orange cloud of thermally excited particles around it, right? And the idea is that the energy that you gain is going to be basically the size of this ring times t. Each particle carries energy t, right? So again, this is solid state physics 101. But this is you can trivially estimate the energy density of a Fermi gas in any dimension. and it's always proportional to t squared. So this should be contrasted with, say, a CFT where it depends strongly on dimension. Okay. So here's the low energy theory. Taking this point very seriously, I can sort of think about at every point in the Fermi surface, I have some kind of fermionic mode, right? A low energy mode that can excite by these particle hole excitations. And so I have just for every point in the Fermi surface, that's integral over the Fermi surface, this effectively one-dimensional system where I have excitation energy radially, right? So I would say this is a CFT, you know, if you want to be fancy, it's a one plus one-dimensional conformal field theory, which is chiral at every point in the Fermi surface. And you can do the same kind of counting here, you know, if you want to compute the thermal energy, for example, it's the number of 1D mode, which is basically Kf, times energy density of a 1D CFT, which is T squared over V, and you get the same thermal entropy. So this is sort of the right low energy theory. It's the right picture. It gives the right thermal entropy. So let's go right to entanglement. So the first thing we need to know is what's the entanglement of a one-dimensional CFT. And this is a universal formula that was first written down by Wilczek and Calabrese, other people, and then Cardi and Calabrese more recently, and many other people since then. And so remember, S is the entropy. This N is the Rinne index. So you can just think about the limit S of N goes to 1 as the entanglement entropy. You want to think about just that one. And it depends on these central charges, which I've called left and right moving central charges, and just log L. So L is the length of an interval in a 1D CFT, and this is the entanglement entropy of that interval. Okay. So for the fermion system, C left is 1, let's say, and C right is 0, because at each point on the Fermi surface, because it's chiral. And so the idea is the entanglement of the Fermi surface is just the sum of these many chiral one-dimensional modes all over the Fermi surface, right? And there's sort of an effective number of Fermi surface points, which is KFL. L is, again, the linear size. And so this says that you sort of have a sort of KFL one-dimensional theories, so you should have an entropy of KFL log L. Okay, this is a rough argument. This was the content of this paper, or part of the content. And it's been pointed out earlier that this L log L violation existed using just some matrix techniques in free fermion theory. But this is a kind of simple intuitive picture of what's going on. We can get more precise. So here again is our region A, spatial region. Let's imagine the Fermi velocity just points straight up. So what you think is as you go along this boundary, so you're sort of integrating over the boundary here. At each different point of the boundary, you're getting a different effective one-dimensional interval, right, of different lengths. So there's this idea of an effective length that each mode sees, which depends on the mode direction and where you are in the real space boundary, right? And so you can think about breaking your region up into these little one-dimensional slices, right, and you're summing this up for each. So each mode, you sum up all these slices, and you sum over all the modes, right? So this is sort of a slight refinement. And so the final output of all this is this nice formula here, which is called the Widom formula, which says that the entropy, the Rinne entropy of a Fermi surface, a free Fermi surface, is an integral over the real space boundary, integral over the Fermi surface, times this flux factor nx and nk are just unit normals to the Fermi surface in the real space region, times log L. And you see, to logarithmic accuracy, I don't need to specify anymore what this L is. That only corrects the subleading area law term, which is anyways not universal. So I don't care about it. So I just put L here, and I don't have to worry about it. So this formula for n equals 1 was conjectured by these people, as the paper I mentioned before, this paper in 06. And then in 09, I gave this sort of heuristic justification for this. And then sort of from there, I went off and made many different additions. So I included the Rinne index, so I computed it for different Rinne entropies. For non-convex regions, so this formula only really works when you have a convex real space region, so you can draw lines through it that don't intersect the boundary more than once, or more than one twice, I guess. I did this thermal crossovers, mutual information, interactions, everything, right? And so I'm gonna tell you about most of these things today. An important part of the story is figuring out what this length should be, this L effective, which I've written here. Because that enters later when you think about the thermal crossovers and when you think about subleading terms. Because if you're going to think about subleading terms, you have to make sure that you're getting this sort of area log, this L log L term correct. Okay, so we'll come to that in a second. So what is this effective length? Let me just tell you right now so you know. The procedure is very simple. I take a point x on the real space boundary and a point k on the Fermi surface, and I look at the normal to the Fermi surface at that point, basically the Fermi velocity, and I draw this line like this, this line here. And then the effective length is just the length of the intersection of this infinite line with A, right? And you see that as long as A is convex, that's always going to be a simple, a well-defined length. So, and this is just really doing what I was showing you before. If you look at this picture, the length of each of these bars is exactly this L effective that I just defined when the Fermi surface vector is pointing straight up. Okay, so this is important later on. Doesn't affect the L log L part, but it affects the subleading stuff.
So this is a real space diagram, but your cut is in momentum space?
No, my cut is in real space. And I'm integrating over different points on the Fermi surface. Right? And so each point, if you fix a point on the real space boundary, each point on the Fermi surface fills a different effective length. So like it would go like this. You would fill a different, whole different sequence of effective lengths, right?
So the previous picture was also real space cut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I try to be consistent and use green color for real space regions. Okay, like I said, this is very important later on for thermal crossovers and for subleading curves. Yeah.
Right, and then this counting of all possible momenta on the Fermi surface for each boundary point in real space, that comes from the expression you wrote before.
Yes.
But could you motivate that expression?
Which expression?
The one where you have an integral over the surface.
Yeah, so it's exactly this picture here. So I clearly have to integrate over 1D modes, right? I mean, each point on the Fermi surface gives a log, like a log L contribution. That's what I said.
So you regard the entropy as a sum of locally contributions?
Yes, exactly. So I'm just adding up different Fermi surface point contributions. That's it. And then each point on the Fermi surface experiences many different effective lengths depending on which sort of region, which part of the real space boundary you're sitting at. Right? And so I'm just telling you, for later purposes, how to compute what's the correct really effective length that this one dimensional mode sees. And it's sort of the obvious one. It's just this chordal distance. Well, you have to put a 1/2 somewhere. Yeah, so that this. No, that's crazy. So this, if you put n equal to 1, this becomes 1/12. So 1/6 of that is the chiral. Is this 1/6? Right here? And then 1/4 of that is, or sorry, 1/2 of that is a number counting. So that's literally everything about this formula. And this 2π is the density of states in momentum space. So it's literally just integrating over k-space, the submanifold in k-space, integrating over real space. There's a 1/2 for double counting, and there's a 1/6 log L for everything.
So this is based on this image where all the k-spaces factorizes into individual nodes.
Yes, that's right.
So no contributions to anything from, say, curvature or anything.
That's right, yeah.
What is the called a Widom formula?
So these gentlemen pointed out that there's related to some conjecture in signal processing. So you can think about signal processing. You have a signal which lives in a finite bandwidth and a finite length of time. So that looks like a Fermi surface, but in time. So there's a conjecture about the way that matrices associated with these signals behave. In fact, there's a larger family. So that's called the Widom conjecture. And this formula is a part of that. And actually, that's recently, very recently been proven, I think, mathematically. But I would say, actually, this kind of Fermi surface picture, especially this mode counting, really gives it a very intuitive picture. I mean, I don't know, maybe mathematicians already, maybe it was already clear to them for some reason. But at least for my purposes, it sort of makes it obviously true. But yeah, so there's some connection there.
Yeah, I'm still a bit confused about the intuition about the whole thing. So the log L is clear from the CFT picture,
yeah.
And then the KF is clear from also from the Fermi surface,
yeah.
Picture. What about the L? Because you have KFL in terms of...
Oh, well, it's just this, right? It's that... Sorry. It's that there are many different, so there's L of these, L little bars, right? So each 1D mode experiences many different effective lengths. So sort of like if you think about a particle sitting here and moving some distance, that gives a little bit of entropy, and then some here moving some distance, that gives some entropy, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Or an alternative way to think about it is that when you're in a finite size system, you discretize momentum. right? Like if you're in a box of size L, then you have some finite resolution in K space. So if you like, I'm discretizing the Fermi surface with a resolution of 1 over L. And that's, again, where this L comes from. So the number of Fermi points that I have, the number of sort of 1D modes depends on L. Okay. So I'm going to say a word about Fermi liquids. So this is just when you turn on interactions in a Fermi surface. The Fermi surface is stable. It still exists. And that's expressed by saying this spectral function, which is defined here, has some quasi-particle residue which remains. So a free Fermi gas has Z equal to 1 and no incoherent part. That's what this ink is. A Fermi liquid has Z less than 1 but not 0. So there is a quasi-particle which remains. And since the early days of Fermi liquid theory, you know, there's this sort of effective Hamiltonian, which Landau wrote down, which has these sort of single particle energies in this kind of forward scattering interaction. And the point is this Hamiltonian has a very large symmetry. Each of these NKs is conserved, right? Because it's just diagonal in the NK basis. And so one can also think of this emergent U1 to the infinity symmetry as protecting this entanglement property. Basically, you can only forward scatter at low energies. And based on this and some other things, I, and then some years later, Ding, Seidel, and Yang argued that a Woodham formula should be valid as long as I evaluate on the interacting Fermi surface. So turning on interactions may shift the size or the topology of the Fermi surface. But whatever the interacting Fermi surface is, which is a well-defined concept, then that gives you the entanglement entropy if you just evaluate the free Woodham formula on it. Okay, so this is the first argument. We'll come back to this in a bit. Okay, so that's Fermi liquid entanglement, the basic entanglement entropy, or the ringy entropy, in the ground state. But now we want to think about thermal to quantum crossovers. And the reason why we're going to do this is because actually it's going to give us a little bit of more leverage on the interacting case. So let's think about that. Okay, so here's what we're going to do now. Instead of the ground state, I'm going to have now just the thermal state, E to the minus H over T. I still trace out the outside region, B, right? And then I look at rho A. Now, if I compute the entropy of rho A, obviously not all that's entanglement now. It's just classical thermal uncertainty, right? Classical entropy. But there is also some entanglement in there. And so the idea that Sinthel and I had, and which appears in some earlier works as well, is, although they didn't really use this, they didn't take this sort of point of view, but they had the formulas, they just computed them for simple 1D systems, is that this S of A and T, so remember A is the real space region, T is temperature, this should be some universal function. That is, it should depend only on the low energy properties of the system up to boundary wall terms, so up to area wall things that are associated with short distance physics. So I can never get rid of that. That's always there, and it's not universal. But somehow, like the L log L is universal. It just depends on the Fermi surface. And similarly, the Fermi surface thermal entropy is also universal. It just depends on the Fermi surface, right, and the density of states. So the idea is there should be some universal crossover function which connects the thermal entropy to the universal parts of the entanglement entropy, because they're basically both being produced by the low energy degrees of freedom. And Sinthel and I wrote down an expression like this, where Z is the dynamical exponent, so it tells you how to relate frequency and momentum. And for the Fermi liquid, Z is 1, but later it can be different for non-Fermi liquids. And so we're going to try to use this formalism to learn something about the Fermi surface. Okay. So first, 1D, as always, in this game. So this is the expression that Cardi and Calabrese produced in one dimension. So you can see that if T goes to 0, the cinch just becomes linear in its argument. The T's cancel, and I get C over 3 log L, right? Whereas if I go to high temperature limit, so if T goes to infinity, then I get log of e to the pi t over 3 times L, and that just the thermal entropy. Right? So this formula has the right structure. And indeed, if you think about it a little bit, you'll see that it's really, you know, you just can take this epsilon outside, and that epsilon is just a constant term, which is an area law in 1D. Right? The area of a 1D interval is just a constant. So this formula really has exactly the form that I was claiming. Right? And this is just an aside, but in this paper, Sinthel and I pointed out that if you take this seriously for z not equal to 1, then it leads to a conjecture about the entanglement structure of gapless spaces in 1D, any gapless space, right? Which is quote unquote reasonable. So what reasonable means is you know, it's in the eye of the beholder to some extent. But it certainly shouldn't have like degenerate ground states or long range interactions or, you know, many, many states at low energy. Sort of, it should roughly just be, you know, like a gapless system, but with some different dynamical scaling. Then we said that in these cases, it should always be log L. So this is a conjecture. I don't know of a counterexample that I would call reasonable, but it's not proven by any means. But this thermal to entanglement crossover has already given some interesting conjecture and result, even in the 1D setting.
So sorry, what is it exactly, the claim? I understand you're saying that you reach the conclusion that in 1D you got the system.
Reasonable ones should have only log L.
What did you use for that?
We use this crossover. So we say that this crossover should basically be well-defined, should be universal, and then you ask what behaviors, you know, you look at the two limits. So it has to reproduce the thermal entropy in one limit, and then has to reproduce the, you know, some unknown entanglement entropy in the other limit, and you ask, you know, what basically when can you decouple the T in a way so that you get rid of the T dependence? Because you have to have something finite as T goes to zero, that's the idea. So basically in this case phi is zero in this setting, and so this function can only have two limits, either constant or log of its argument, which allow you to remove the T dependence with a purely area law term. Okay, so you go through some argument, which I can go through if you want, and you reach this conclusion.
Is the one-dimensional part not
phi? So this works also in higher dimensions. This will predict that the subleading term, which is universal, is either a constant or a log, and that's indeed what's observed in CFTs. It's constant in odd space-time dimension, even space dimension. Yes, is that right? That's right, Rob. And it's log in odd spatial dimension, or even space-time dimension. Okay. But we can also do this for the Fermi surface. So here's my formula that I wrote down. You basically do the same integrals as before. You're integrating over your modes and over your one-dimensional, over your boundary and your modes, right? You have your flux factor. But now I just put the 1D crossover function in. And the remarkable thing is that this works exactly the same way. So if you look at low temperature, you get just the Whitman formula out. But now if you look at high temperature, you can do the same thing. You get this pi t L effective over VF, which comes out of the log, right? And the remarkable thing is that this L effective, when defined in the way that I defined earlier, it just gives you the volume when you integrate it over dA, right? So this simple, it's sort of obvious from this picture. And it's adding up like these little widths here, times the height. It's like calculus when you learn how to compute the volume of the area of a region doing an integral. It's literally just that. Okay. So the first sort of feature of this L effective is that when you put it into this crossover formula, it actually just gives you the volume out. And then you get just the usual thermal entropy, which is proportional to the volume of the region. And then this 1 over VF is the conventional density of states. So you integrate 1 over VF over the Fermi surface, and you get the density of states. And that's what we all know is the thermal entropy of a Fermi surface. It's just the volume times the density of states times temperature squared. Or I guess times temperature for the entropy. Okay. So the point is, what I've told you is that there's this one-dimensional formulation. I put this one-dimensional crossover in there, and I can reproduce the thermal entropy of a Fermi gas using this formulation. So as far as I know, no one had ever done this before. So it's another way to compute the entropy of a Fermi gas in any dimension from this one-dimensional framework. And it's not just heuristic. It's not just, you know, goes like volume. It's really the exact, everything exactly works out, all the numerical factors of pi and 3 and so forth. Okay. Now, what does this tell us about Fermi liquids? Well, so when you have quasi-particles, one thing that happens is that the velocity gets renormalized in principle. Or if you like, in the language of quadratic bands, the effective mass changes. And so there's a natural guess for what the crossover function is for Fermi liquids, which is I just replace V by V star. Okay. And again, this gives the right thermal entropy of a Fermi liquid. So we know the thermal entropy of a Fermi liquid from Landau's arguments. And it just depends on this V star. It doesn't depend on anything else. It doesn't depend on any Landau parameters. And so the natural guess is that this crossover function still applies, and you just got to renormalize this unit which converts from length to time, okay, or from length to energy. And so this is something I pointed out again some years ago, 2 years ago, and or 2.5 years ago now. This crossover formula correctly reproduces the thermal entropy of the interacting gas, and so it's some extra support for this claim that I made of universality. That is, the Wooden formula is valid even for the interacting Fermi surface, as long as you evaluate it on the interacting Fermi surface.
So you're saying that you have this formula, and since
yeah.
it reproduces the higher low temperature limits, then it seems like it describes the whole
yeah, I'm saying, so what I'm saying is I have a formula for free fermions, and I can make a simple modification of that which works for interacting fermions in the high temperature limit. And so it's natural to, I mean, it's not a proof, of course, but it's a natural guess to think that it works everywhere. And then it leads to the conclusion, if that's true, if this is a crossover function. If this is the right one, then it shows that this Wooden formula is true even in the interacting case. Okay, so all I'm saying is I have a candidate for the crossover function. And it happens to have the property that says the Wooden formula is correct even for the interacting case. So basically, the only thing that can happen is that there could be functions of the Landau parameter which enters, which go to zero in a large temperature limit, but which become some finite thing at zero temperature. But it really doesn't make sense. I mean, it's pretty certainly, well, I mean, in fact, I'll show you later, it's definitely equal to this Wooden formula, but it's pretty clearly going to get given just by the Wooden formula, because you have these quasi-particles, and they're basically the same extended free states, and they don't really interact with each other except by forward scattering. So I think it's even at this point, you should believe that this is the right answer. Okay, just so it's not just about Fermi liquids, but also about non-Fermi liquids. So an example which is maybe relevant for these organic materials is to consider a spin liquid where you have a spin-on Fermi surface and a couple to a gauge field. Right? So this is a problem people have dealt with extensively in the past. And so again, this kind of crossover argument will give you the conclusion. So in this case, this phi is -1/z. So this is what happens in higher dimensions. So there's a power of 1/t in front, which is getting bigger and bigger at low t. So this has to go like the argument at small t to cancel that diverging power of t. And then the remaining powers of t can either be removed by having just a constant or by having a log. So you can't have, for example, log squared or log, something like that. That doesn't work. So we reach this conclusion that, again, these entropy of these things can be at most L log L. And just a comment, which maybe I'll expand more upon tomorrow, is that we've also similarly recently found some crossovers in holographic models called hyperscaling violation metrics. It's not clear that these are really Fermi surfaces, but in fact, they may definitely not be Fermi surfaces, but they still have a similar entanglement structure. And so it's an open question in sort of what's going on in these situations. Okay, so that's all for the thermal crossover. So what I've done so far is I've told you about the leading entanglement structure of free gas, and I've sort of tried to convince you that even for interacting Fermi liquids, that the Wooden formula is still true, right? And I told you about this thermal crossover, which enables us to get some other results in 1D, for example, or to give some support to this claim for Fermi liquids. Right. Now I'm going to tell you about subleading terms. This is much more recent work, basically motivated by quantum Monte Carlo data by Jeremy McInnes and Norm Tubman, which appeared maybe a month or two ago, 3 months ago. So I'm really good at computing things with Fermi surfaces now. So I was able to compute these terms very quickly. And we now have a paper about this. So here's the basic idea. In a Fermi surface system, you have what are called Friedel oscillations, right? And that basically arises because this is just the density-density correlation function, right? For the free gas. And you see these Fs are the Fermi occupation functions. Right? And so what it looks like here is I'm sort of taking a difference of two different Fermi surfaces, right? One shifted by Q relative to the other one. And so you see what happens is that when Q is 2kF, you get a singularity, right? Because they stop overlapping. So there's some singularity in chi at Q of order 2kF, or Q equal to 2kF. And this leads, when you Fourier transform to real space, leads to two oscillations at a wave vector of 2kF. Right? So this is an old story about, like, if I put an impurity in a Fermi liquid, I get some oscillations around it, some pattern. But these oscillations, maybe not surprisingly, also appear in the entropy also appear in the entanglement entropy. So these people talked about these oscillations in a 1D system for free fermions and also for Leminger liquids. And they didn't consider the general case, but at least for their specific case, the oscillations did match this 2kF. So maybe they were like every other site or something like that, at half filling. So what we want to do is first understand these oscillations in 1D and then do our game of taking them to higher dimension, right? So here's how to think about it in 1D. This is the electron operator. Remember my C of X and T, and I'm decomposing this as a left mover and a right mover. So I have two Fermi points, and I look at the fermions localized near the left mover and the right mover. And this is the fermion. And these psi left and psi right, these are the slowly varying fields in which I can build a low energy description. All right, and now the replica trick to computing this entropy just says that I get this entropy by computing trace of rho A to the N. Right? That was the definition back on page one of the Rényi entropy. And again, the limit as n goes to 1 is the entanglement entropy. But the way you compute trace rho A to the n is that you basically introduce some branch surface, right? Remember at the beginning I talked about you can measure entanglement entropy by putting multiple copies together and putting some coherent interactions between them. So it's something very similar here. I'm not going to draw, but you have a branch surface. You have these branch points. And the idea, which has been long known in the statistical mechanics literature, but which was first pointed out in the context of entanglement by Cardi and Calabresi, is that these branch points can bind operators, just think of them as impurities. So the impurities can have some effect. They can produce some oscillations or some ripples in the Fermi surface, because of the Fermi surface. And then these oscillations can affect this partition function, right? They can affect the trace. And so the idea is, in this case, the relevant operator for getting these 2kF oscillations is that there's a density. Here's the density. There's a 2kF part of the density, which connects the left mover to the right mover. And these branch points basically bind impurities. They bind this operator. And this operator affects the partition function. And you can compute this if you want to get technical, with this conformal transformation here. So this is Z1 and Z2 are the two branch points. So you can think about Z1 and Z2 being separated by L, which is an interval. And you can use this combined with the fact that these are conformal primaries to compute the effect of these branch point impurities on, because of these relevant operators, you can compute the effect of them on trace rho to the n. Okay, so that's the kind of simple picture. And now we just integrate that over the Fermi surface, as we always do. That's the message. So this part here is essentially what happens. This is the result from the 1D calculation. So you see here's the n, the branch point. This 2 is basically the dimension, 2 times the dimension of that operator, psi left, psi right. And this cosine 2kF is exactly that e to the I 2kF that I showed you before. Right? And then I just integrate this over the Fermi surface. And this Fn isn't some parameter which you can compute. So the field theory doesn't determine Fn. It gives a cutoff dependent answer for Fn. But at least for free fermions, you can actually compute this. And these people here, Calabresi and his collaborators, they computed this Fn for free fermions. So we use their computation. And then here's the data. Okay, so here A is a disk. The radius is L. We can also do a cylinder. You get a similar answer. And this is the Rényi entropies from 1 to 5. Not sure why it's shaking. Someone's moving fast. the dashed lines, which you can't see, are the data, and the solid lines are the theory prediction. And you see that they agree perfectly. Okay. And the only thing that we're fitting here is the L term. Everything else is predicted from the theory. Okay. So I'm pretty. That's a good agreement for one parameter. So here's the details. We fit a function of this form, right? So there's 5 parameters. And theory predicts A1, A3, A4, and A5 for the free case. The only thing I don't know is A2, the coefficient of this non-universal area law piece. right? And then when I turn on interactions, I argue that because the quasi-particle is good, then this power law here, which is really just a property of the quasi-particle, that will remain good. And this wave vector, that will also remain good. Now the amplitude may change, and indeed it does. So I still have three parameters out of five that I fit, with the theory. I don't know. So this is the fit, and we sort of have this argument that interactions aren't going to modify this, right? And so just again, this is the result. This is just fitting one parameter. I get all the oscillation, I get the wave vector, I get the power law decay, I get the prefactor, and I get the L log L term all correct. All I have to do is fit the L term. Okay, and the same, you can do any geometry. Right, so all the geometric stuff encoded in this formula, that's all correct. And you see again that L effective is playing a crucial role here. Right? If I didn't have this L effective right, I wouldn't get the right answer. So this L effective is the same L effective that made the thermal crossover correct, and it's the same L effective that makes this match the data so nicely. Mm-hmm. Right, so this really is the right way to think about this thing. Yeah?
Yeah, just to make sure I understand, there's no real impurity here, right? It's just like a virtual, it's because it's a cut and it's infinite.
Yeah, if you like, the effect of the impurity vanishes as you go to n equals 1. But it may not vanish fast enough. You know, there may be some leftover effects. And if you keep it finite n, then this impurity is there. It's really a branch surface. Okay. So we also have a claim about the interactions. This is this Monte Carlo data that Jeremy and Norm first produced. So what's plotted here is just S2 divided by the L for a disk. So ignore this box for a second. The black line is the Fermi gas result. So they just have the exact wave function. And then these different data sets are wave functions for a Coulomb gas in two dimensions, right? So it's just fermions with Coulomb interaction. They use a Jastrow wave function. They use quantum Monte Carlo to compute these entropies using a swap trick. Okay. And the first thing to note is that this blue data here agrees perfectly with the black data, right? And now this is at RS of 1. That's a pretty strong, you know, you can think about RS as measuring the strength of Coulomb interaction, right? It's the potential energy divided by the kinetic energy. So this is basically saying the potential energy is equal to kinetic energy in the system. And the agreement with the non-interacting data is essentially perfect. The L log L is right, the oscillations are right, everything is right. And in fact, what happens when you go to higher interactions, so bigger RS is bigger interaction, mostly what happens is you just move up, which since this is S over L, that just means you're shifting the constant piece, which is not universal, so I don't have any, you know, it's fine if these curves all float upwards. That's okay. They claim in their paper that there's a slight difference. This is now the difference, I guess, the leading term, the L log L term over L between the free gas and the interacting gas at these different RSs using their trial wave function. So they want to claim that there's a small difference in the leading L log L term at very large interactions. So like probably it's a Wigner crystal. It's a crystal at like 30 or something like that. You know, I don't know exactly where, but these are very, very strongly interacting systems, and they claim there's some small difference in this L log L term. Now that's not predicted by the theory, but at the same time, we don't really know. I mean, they don't have much data and they have very big error bars. So it's not clear to me this is a real thing, but it's still an open question. So there is a little bit left to do. Yeah.
How do they even analyze the acting patterns in the first place?
Sorry, how do they do what?
So this is a two-dimensional system of
antiquity. Yeah, it's variational wave function. So they take free fermions, they multiply by Jastrow, and then they minimize the energy.
But these systems are large, right?
Well, like these are like 100 and something particles, like 200 particles.
100 particles?
Like 200 particles.
But that's, right, on a lattice.
No, it's in a continuum.
In the continuum.
Yeah, everything here is in a continuum. So this is very nice data, and they had to work hard to get this. And the moral of the story is that this is just agreeing perfectly with what we've said up till now. Even the oscillations are right. Okay. So let me just conclude with sort of one of the, again, a very new result, which really kind of nails down some of these interaction issues very, very firmly. Okay. And this is the idea of something I call entanglement sum rule. So here's a lattice model. Obviously, I don't expect you to understand what's going on here, but basically you have fermions these are my C's. They have some hopping and they have a chemical potential. And you also have spins, sigma Z, which live on the links. So it's as if this fermion C coupled to what like a Z2 gauge field or something like that. And you have various terms. So you have a term which is the gauge field along links. That's this guy here. You have a term which is like the star term in the toric code or in Z2 gauge theory, like the term which says the charge must be equal to zero at each point. And you have a Plaquette term. So this star term means I take a site R and I multiply sigma X for all the four adjacent bonds if it's on a square lattice. And this Plaquette term is I take a Plaquette and I multiply sigma Z around. So the nice thing about this wave function is that, or this Hamiltonian, sorry, is that basically everything commutes except for these two terms. So these guys don't commute with each other, but they commute with everything else. And so it's a very soluble model. And so in fact, you can make progress on this. You can do a decoupling transformation, starting from the fact that these fluxes are all conserved. And so you can set them equal to 1, right? And then there you that's the first step. And the second step is to introduce some new variables, some taus and f's. And the taus are defined this way. So you're basically solving this constraint. You want to solve it, you want to make it trivial, right? So the new variables automatically satisfy the constraint. So the way to do that is to replace sigma z with two other Ising spins, two other sigma like polymatrices, tau x and tau x on R and tau x on R prime. So you sort of split a sigma z into two sites. For each of these star terms, the product of sigma x around a star, you replace that with a tau z. And then the fermions become tau x times some other fermion fr. And the virtue of this is that it preserves all the commutation relations. Everything is good as long as the taus are polymatrices and the f's are conditional fermions. So this transformation of variables captures all of the degrees of freedom in this constrained subspace right here. And the final step is a decoupling step where I just make some tilted tau variables that get rid of this -1 to the number of fermions on a site. And what you're left over with is free fermions plus an Ising model. So let's just look at that for a second. So this becomes just f's, right? Because each of the sigma z's gets a tau. Each of the c's gets a tau. So the two taus annihilate. So I just get f dagger f. This becomes f dagger f. This becomes tau x. And this becomes just tau z right here. And this term is just a constant. It just drops out. So it's just free fermions plus an Ising model in terms of these two variables. Now, why is this a good model to think about? Well, first of all, the ground state is very simple in the decoupled variables. So that already suggests that maybe you can compute the entanglement entropy very simply in this model. But you need to be very careful because f and tau tilde are not local in the original variables. So there's going to be some game you have to play to get back to the original variables. But nevertheless, you can do a lot of nice things. So for example, if you want to compute the fermion correlation function, remember this is, I don't know what I'm doing. That's not what I'm doing, I don't know. This is just the fermion part, right? Times the tau x correlation function. Right? That's what I showed you before. And since this is always free fermions, you can see that what the role of the tau x is actually to make this quasiparticle residue. So if the tau x's are condensed, so if they're in a phase where average value of tau x is non-zero, then this looks like a free fermion correlator, except there's this factor of z in front, where z is average of tau x squared. Right? You're just treating this in the lowest order in the condensed phase. Right? And similarly, when tau x is not condensed, then it's not a Fermi liquid because z is zero. Right? So this model reaches interesting phases, and it's totally under control. Here's the phase diagram, so here's the model again. As a function of this tuning parameter G, which is in front of this sizing term here. Right? So remember, this is like tau x, and this is like tau z. So as you make G, if G is small, then you just have tau z equal to 1. That's sort of like the toric code limit, or the Z2, the deconfined Z2 gauge theory limit. That's over here, and in that case, the average value of tau x is 0, because tau z is equal to 1, right? So average value of tau x is 0. And that's a non-Fermi liquid metal, which was called an orthogonal metal because it's orthogonal to the original fermions. And but it still has a Fermi surface, just a Fermi surface of F instead of C's. right? And then on the other side of this transition, which is an Ising transition, you have tau x not equal to zero. And in this case, you have a finite z, you have a Fermi liquid. And this is how z decays as you go to the critical point. Just goes down to some known related to the Ising order parameter. Okay, so this is the phase diagram. And now the amazing thing is that I was able to prove that for this model, the entanglement entropy is just exactly as. So it's the F fermions plus a contribution from the taus, but written in the right variables, right? So you still have to do some non-local transformation. So this is a little hard to compute. This is trivial to compute based on what I told you before. This is a little hard to compute, but it can be done. For example, in the limit of g is zero, it's just this sort of like a toric code result, for example. And the limit of g equal to infinity, it's just nothing because it's a product state. Yeah?
So you wrote in a previous slide that the wave function factorizes in f and tau?
Yes.
Well, then that's why.
But the point is that this is, I don't trace out over f and tau, I trace out over c and sigma. And c and sigma are related to f and tau non-locally. So I'm not actually, so it's true that spatially these guys are decoupled. But I'm actually not tracing out spatial regions anymore. I'm tracing out as a function of these guys. I'm tracing out some complicated non-local thing as a function of these guys, where they don't obviously factorize. They're tied together and they're mixed up in some non-local way.
Yeah, but that enters the value that has S of F, right? And S of tau. But the fact that it's the sum of S of F and S of tau should come, right?
It's I don't think it's obvious. I mean,
is this expression coming from the fact that there is a representative matrix for the region that you want to look at, which factorizes as a tensor product of two?
It does not factorize.
Right.
Yeah.
So therefore, this is non-trivial.
Yeah, the density matrix does not factorize.
Okay.
But it happens to be that if you think carefully about it, it looks sort of locally like it's unitary. It's a local unitary of a factorized density matrix in such a way that this formula still holds.
Okay.
So it's highly non-trivial.
But is this formula also true for Rennie entropies?
Yes. So.
So then
exactly additive, valid, all finite, all Rennie entropies, all parameters.
So does this mean the spectrum of
the spectrum factorizes,
factorizes,
but the states don't factorize? Okay, so this is the punchline. It's exactly additive, it's valid finite temperature, all the Rennies, all the parameters. Okay, this is a vast generalization of some results of Hong Yao and Xiaoling Qi and myself and Senthol from a few years ago. Okay, and so this. Sum rule is really, really nice because it does a lot of things immediately for us. So one thing is that it immediately gives us a Fermi liquid with a non-trivial quasi-particle residue, which can actually go all the way to zero, but where the entanglement is provably exactly just this L log L from the Widom formula. I can actually prove completely rigorously that this cannot give you an L log L, completely rigorously. And this is sort of certainly L log L with a usual prefactor. We know all about that. So I can rigorously prove that for this interacting Fermi liquid, the Widom formula is correct on the interacting Fermi surface. Another application is that you can check this thermal entanglement Coulson over that I talked about before, which I said gave some evidence, additional evidence for the Widom formula in the interacting case. And it also you can also check that it's universal there. So exactly the free fermion formula with just V replaced by V star, which in this case doesn't actually, it's V is V star, but it's a simple check, but it still works. And you know, this is I just presented this story for the Fermi surface case, but it actually works for a huge variety of models. So like all kinds of spin liquids and different kinds of metals and just all kinds of transitions. So there's a huge class of models now where this formalism gives you this exact so-called sum rule, where you relate the entanglement of the full system to its two components, to like the matter part and the gauge theory part, or the matter part and the spin part. So that's it. Let me summarize what have we learned. Well, we certainly learned a lot about the entanglement of Fermi liquids. That's true. And that's interesting, at least to me. But the more importantly, I think we've been able to check a lot of non-trivial claims about universality. We've been able to check these ideas of thermal entanglement crossovers, which have been useful in other contexts. We've been able to show that there can be quantitative agreements where we really sort of know everything that you can know between theory and experiment, numerical experiments, this quantum Monte Carlo data. you can, even in this highly gapless interacting system, you can quantitatively get all this stuff right that, that you could possibly predict from a universal theory. And then finally, I would just say, you know, entanglement is a very complicated thing, but, it, you know, a lot of these ideas of scaling and universality that people have been developing over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, they really are proven to be a good guide, a good starting point, which we've really kind of, you know, we sort of worked out everything in gory detail here. We have every aspect of this problem under control, Fermi liquids. And so we can really check everything in complete detail, and it sort of works very nicely. So we're sort of trying to edge towards a real comprehensive understanding of the structure of entanglements in quantum matter more generally, but especially in these Fermi surface systems. So let me just conclude by saying that, you know, there is a big picture here. Entanglement is just some part of quantum matter. And like I said at the beginning, I'm really interested in quantum matter as a unified subject. There's a lot of things related to entanglement you can think about doing. There's non-Fermi liquid entanglement, so I gave you these crossover functions, but you can try to compute these things for these different states. There's connections to holography. This is a holographic picture of one of these hyperscaling violation things. And there's sensor network approaches that I'll also have some interplay with everything I've told you today. So that I'll talk about more tomorrow if you're interested. And but yeah, there's a lot to do, and it's exciting. We made a lot of progress, but there's still a lot to do. So with that, let me just thank you.
So what part of the quantum matter is not entanglement?
What do you mean? Well, actually, they, you know, there's like quantum algorithms that don't rely on entanglement, but still get a speed up. They do exist. I mean, entanglement is clearly important, but you know, I like to think about something like the Ising model and like some highly non-abelian, non-positive weights, like complicated topological state. They have roughly the same entanglement structure in terms of just the basic scaling. But clearly one of them is somehow much more complicated than the other one. Like one can be done in quantum Monte Carlo, one can't. Right? So at least there's some refinement of entanglement we need to think about. You know, something more to do with, I don't know, the spatial structure or something. So in that sense it's something beyond entanglement. You know, entanglement is you know, maybe it's the states of the Schmidt decomposition. I don't know, you know, what exactly it is. Not just the spectrum, perhaps. Or maybe it is the spectrum, I'm not sure, you know. But yeah, I think there's more to the world then.
Cool.
Than quantum entanglement. Although you wouldn't know it from my publication list.
See, it's beautiful, but how will you tell an experiment at least to measure this?
Well, it's very hard. Yeah, so in principle, it can be done. What you need to do is, well, you need a quantum computer, basically. So first, you should build one of those. And then you should do the experiment. So more seriously, there have been some proposals for maybe measuring this in quinches, where you start with a ground state and try to do something. But from my perspective, there's a better suggestion, which is to look at the fluctuations of conserved quantities. So one of the reasons why the entanglement entropy obeys an area law is because if you have singlets inside the region, they don't contribute. So it's sort of only things that cross the boundary contribute. And so, for example, in this is actually gives me a good opportunity to tell about Senthil. So this is what Senthil computed for me. So if you define the number operator, which just is equal to the integral of the density operator over some region, right, then you can compute the variance of this guy. And it turns out that this goes like KFL log L for essentially the same reasons, because only fluctuations across the boundary contribute, and you have this one-dimensional picture, and all the one-dimensional guys have log L number fluctuations, and you add that up. So I can tell you the precise number in front of here, again, with a very similar formula to the Widom formula. So what we actually were computing recently is, for Fermi liquids, this is not unchanged. It depends on some unknown function of F naught, the zero sound Fermi liquid parameter, Landau parameter, and we computed this function. So it turns out that at large F naught, this goes like 1 over square root of F naught. This is what Senthil and I were computing, for those of you who want to know. It's not hard, just do some with this density correlation function. But so something like this is definitely much more measurable. And it encodes a lot of the same physics. I mean, the Fermi surface is there. You can see the geometry of the Fermi surface just by looking at this this leading term. You can learn about the Landau parameters by looking at these fluctuations. So actually, there, you know, we're thinking about looking at, you know, proposing to look at the fluctuations in these organic spin liquids, to like look at the spin fluctuations, the charge fluctuations, and try to see actually if there's a signature of a Fermi surface there. So that's one kind of entanglement-y sort of thing that you could actually measure experimentally, and which may be useful, but we don't know yet. It's also easier to measure numerically. So.
Some of the standard neutron scattering experiments.
Yes.
They do measure.
Yeah, I mean, they're measuring the susceptibility at different points in momentum and as a function of frequency. So here we're saying, like, for example, so you can take these NV centers in diamond, right, and you can lower them on top of the metal. I mean, you can't put it too close because you have to read them out by fluorescence. So when you put it too close to metal, it just shuts down the fluorescence. But you could try to kind of put it reasonably close. And then the spin here can detect the fluctuations of the magnetic field due to the metal. And so in principle, actually, the fluctuations of this spin know about the fluctuations of some patch of the metal set by the dipole interaction, right? So you know, maybe it's possible. So Amir Jacoby at Harvard is actually thinking about doing experiments of this type. So it may be possible to actually look at this particular, you know, this is like some weird version of the density-density correlation function where you're at equal time, you integrate over some patch. So it's just a particular measurable observable, which may reveal a Fermi surface in a nice way. We don't know yet.
More questions?
You said these sum rules can be proved generically for different spin liquids.
Yeah. I mean, not every spin liquid obeys a sum rule. In fact, maybe most don't in some sense, but many do.
So which class did you have in mind? I mean,
well, so for example, if the topological structure is involved as a Chern-Simons term, then this is not true. But if it's like Zn gauge theory or some kind of pure gauge theory coupled to a fluctuating charged matter, where the matter is only charged, it doesn't like carry flux also of the gauge theory, then this is true for that case. So it's really mostly when you're mixing charge and flux, like so when the gauge field and the charge sector mix in a complicated way that you can't prove this sum rule. But when it's like charges just coupled to a gauge theory, you can prove it for that case. And you know, it's not just, you don't have to call it gauge theory either, you can just call it spins. So then there's a lot of spin models where the sum rule is valid. And you can use it to compute these things, compute these entropies.
Okay. More?
Let's say mine again.